We did it again. Verizon was just named America's most reliable network by Root Metrics for the 16th time in a row, proving once again that nobody builds networks like Verizon builds networks. That's why we're building 5G right. That's why there's only one best network, Verizon. Best and most reliable based on Root Metrics reports from second half 2013 to first half 2021 of three operators on all network types combined, not specific to 5G networks.
Hi, and welcome to the Less K-12 Better Podcast. This podcast is a project between Mama Bowl Capes and her kids.
Hi!
In our podcast, we will cover a variety of subjects involving K-12 education and family life.
We will talk about the ways that parents, kids, and educators can improve K-12 education and family life.
We encourage you to join our conversation on social media using the hashtag #LetsK12Better.
Let's jump into Season 2, Episode 9 of the Let's K12 Better podcast.
The Stop AAPI Hate National Report, released March 16th, showed that 3,795 incidents were reported to the Stop AAPI Hate Reporting Center between March 19th of 2020 and February 28th, 2021. Of those almost 4,000 statements, 68% of reported incidents were verbal harassment, with women reporting 2.3 times more than men. We read that short 11-page report together as a family and held a conversation. On the same day that the Stop AAPI Hate report was released, a gunman murders Soon Chung Park, Hyung Chung Grant, Soon Cha Kim, Young A. Yu, Delania Ashley Yun, Paul Andre Michelle, Xiao Jie Tan, and Dao Yo Feng. We later hear that the Cherokee County Sheriff's Office on national television state that the shooting suspect was, quote, having a bad day, end quote, which signaled for many of us that the value of life and humanity was placed on the gunmen and not the victims and their families. The sheriff's office has since apologized and acknowledged this oversight. In the push for a more just and anti-racist world, we must stand against injustice, racism, colorism, and xenophobia targeted at any community. The problem isn't just that people don't like each other. The problem is the policies that prevent individuals and groups from full access to civic participation and a safe quality of life. The problem is the lack of innovative thought when thinking about how humans can live together and who belongs and who does not. The problem is historic erasure and an inability to rectify our past through the narratives we shape for ourselves, our classrooms, and in our communities. When we are not impacted directly by injustice, the problem, for many of us, is ineptitude, cowardice, or comfort. Fortunately, the solution is collaborative. The solution is holistic and not centered around white normative experiences. And the solution requires literally everyone's participation and engagement insofar as they are willing and able to produce a future experience in which none of us feel small, ugly, inadequate, useless, ashamed, intimidated, invisible, or silenced. Normally, when we have discussions about racism, we sit down as a family. This time, we expanded our kitchen table and invited four awesome history educators, all Asian women, to join us in a discussion on how we can combat hate, acknowledge hurt, engage healing, and cultivate hope as we support our Asian and Pacific Islander friends, family, students, and colleagues. In this episode, you'll hear from Angela Lee, a 20-plus year veteran world history educator striving to bring diverse and global perspectives into her classroom. Carol Lee Wong Nakatsuka, a passionate and friendly 8th grade U.S. history teacher committed to putting the we in We the People by teaching an inclusive and diverse history. Stacey Young, a middle school history teacher, edtech enthusiast, and social justice advocate. And Virginia Nguyen, a committed anti-racist educator who spent her teaching career committed to creating a classroom that celebrates diversity. We hope that you grow from this awesome discussion. We are delighted to have Angela, Carol Lee, Stacey, and Virginia join us today. Carol Lee reached out to me about an episode that would help parents and educators not only address and acknowledge the racism experienced by Asian communities, but also provide tangible opportunities to engage the work required to end racism and xenophobia. Ladies, welcome to the podcast. We are so thankful that you are willing to share your wisdom with us today. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you so much for having us, Amber.
Yeah,
we're so honored to be here.
We're so excited for this conversation.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. So let's start off with our first question. Would you like to read our first question?
Uh-huh. Let's start off with some brief introductions. Can each of you share a bit about who you are with our listeners?
I'll start. I am Angela Lee. I am a high school world history teacher outside of the Boston area in a suburb about 30 minutes outside of Boston, where I've spent 20 plus years trying to bring diverse and global perspectives into my world history classroom and to other educators.
Hi, everyone. I'm Stacey Young. I teach middle school history in Orange County, California. I'm an edtech enthusiast and a social justice advocate. I strive to promote student voice and to empower students to be active citizens in their communities and globally.
Hi, everyone. I'm Carol Lee Wong Nakatsuka. I'm a passionate and friendly 8th grade U.S. history teacher in Southern California, and I'm committed to putting the we into We the People by teaching an inclusive and diverse history where students see themselves and others who don't look like them through an empathetic lens so they develop into engaged, informed, active, and empathetic citizens.
Hello there. My name is Virginia Nguyen, and I'm a Vietnamese American. I've taught for 16 years in 4 different districts in Southern California and Illinois. I'm a proud history teacher. I really believe understanding history allows one to understand yourself. And the truest account of history is one that's diverse, inclusive, equitable, celebrates joy, brings allyship, all to empower our students. I am so proud to be here with all these other educators because I love being a teacher. I cannot imagine any other profession that is more full of hope because we believe that humanity can be and does and can do better.
Sounds like we have the dream team here today. So I am super thankful that you guys have come onto the show. You have a wealth of knowledge amongst the four of you, and I just can't wait to get into these. So let's just jump right in to this question from Garvey.
The Stop AAPI Hate National Report showed an increase in reported racist and xenophobic rhetoric has contributed to an increase in hate crimes and violence against Asian Americans. Would each of you share your own personal experiences with racism, what coping mechanisms you've used, or journeys you've had with being an Asian American woman in the United States?
Well, thanks so much for the question, Garvey. That report that just came out on March 16, the same day as the Atlanta shootings, was very disturbing, but it's not something that is new. There has been an increase, yes, in this past year with the pandemic, but this is something that I've experienced all my life. I have a lot of stories to tell, but the one I want to share today is something that I experienced in high school. And it was in my senior year in high school, and I was the president of the Asian Club at my high school, which had a large percentage of Asians, probably about 15% at that time, which was a large percentage. And we were hosting a big event, as we did every year, that was really for the community. And at one point, I was walking through the hallways and I saw a bunch of the posters that I had personally posted up, pulled down with racial slurs written all over them against Asians. I had gathered all of them together and I brought them to the principal and the vice principal. And this was like 30 years ago. And what they said to me was, well, we don't know who did it, so there's nothing we can do about it. And I think that is one of the things that I have felt over and over again and with a lot of these incidences, that feeling of invisibility. I know that my friends here have a lot of other stories to share.
Thanks, Angela. It all resonates with all of us. When you ask me, what are your experiences with racism? If you just ask me right out like that, I would think like, I don't really recall anything. It takes me longer to remember it because most of the incidents are just a regular part of life for Asian Americans. They're mostly in the form of microaggressions. There've been really louder and more obvious ones. Like in college, when I was in college, I was the only Asian in a small class. And I still remember a white student criticizing Asians and I was the only Asian. Something I think probably about like us taking up all the spots in college or something like that. And they also, I don't remember the exact exchange, but I remember the black classmate who stood up and defended me. And because of my imposter syndrome, because of my insecurity, because of the experiences of my life, I didn't feel that I could speak up. And so most of our racist incidents are in the form of microaggressions. Dr. Alex Jung calls microaggressions death by 1,000 paper cuts. And we just kind of learn to live with those paper cuts. And it's only recently that I started to realize and started to speak up.
Thank you for sharing that, Carolee. Likewise, for myself, like Carolee was saying, it's nothing, not always overt. It's not always in your face type racism, and it's not always physical. For myself, it was really feeling like a perpetual foreigner, despite being born and raised in Southern California, constantly having to field the question, where are you from? No, but where are you really from? As if Los Angeles or California wasn't enough. And growing up, and even as an adult, it's that constant kind of battle between the model minority myth, where it's always, you know, they highlight some characteristic about me that they want to highlight because I'm Asian, but they don't see all of me. Versus sometimes the yellow peril or what we're seeing right now, where because I'm Asian, because I'm Chinese American, people look at me like I'm a threat or I'm a danger. And so it's just conflicting with these two characteristics that everyone else sees about me. And in coping with this, I think having just growing up, internalizing all of these feelings, I always felt silenced. And like Carolee mentioned and Angela a little bit, this imposter syndrome, am I good enough? Will the world see me for who I actually am and not just what they see on the outside? And it wasn't until I felt allyship and I had colleagues that were also Asian American or people who wanted to learn more about my background that and finding these friends here in this room, did I finally get the courage to speak up and speak out about this, and now, you know, starting to share my story with others.
Hi, everyone. This is Virginia here. And Angela, Carolee, Stacy, all the stories that they've shared are stories that I myself can completely identify with, too. But I wanted to talk about the complexity of racism, right? So here we are as Asian American women, and that's a whole nother issue, is like the intersectionality of being women along with being Asian American. But that racism is complex. And as we look at racism, right, we also, as Asian Americans, we want to acknowledge that there have been verbal and physical assaults that racism asserts on our Black and brown brothers and sisters that have been significantly painful and have harmful histories too. But we're not here to compare stories or divide, because it's that same type of thinking that further reinforces this hierarchy of power that we're here together to dismantle. Instead, we're here as fellow people of color to unite, tell our stories so that we can dismantle these systems rather than reinforce them.
So each of you, and first of all, I just want to, again, thank you all for being super vulnerable with Garvey's question, because I just want to acknowledge that it's not easy to open up and talk about things that are painful or things that have caused harm to you over your lifetime that either you've dealt with or are figuring out how to deal with. So I just want to thank you guys for being so vulnerable with us. I also just want to highlight, you know, I think, you know, Angela touched upon the invisibility factor. Carolee touched upon microaggression. Stacey touched upon this continued, like, this idea about being a foreigner or being categorized as a foreigner. And then Virginia, thank you so much for bringing in the intersectionality piece. You know, I often wonder, you know, with those things, if you could just share a bit more about how do you guys deal with those, with that, right? How do you, like what does that do? It's just to give our listeners a bit more insight into how that impacts people when things like that happen.
I guess I can share a little bit. I think part of the...
We did it again. Verizon was just named America's most reliable network by Root Metrics for the 16th time in a row, proving once again that nobody builds networks like Verizon builds networks. That's why we're building 5G right. That's why there's only one best network, Verizon. Best and most reliable based on Root Metrics reports from second half 2013 to first half 2021 of three operators on all network types combined, not specific to 5G networks.
Something that we've been, you know, connecting all together and talking, that's striving to be perfect in everything we do and working so hard and putting all that effort in, just keeping our head down, keeping compliant, following all the rules, doing all the right things. And these seem to be very common coping mechanisms. And we see, I know that in my community, and what the data plays out is that this is especially harmful to the Asian American communities, our young people, because of all the push to be perfect. The Asian American community actually has the highest rate of mental health issues. And I know that could take a lot more to unpack, but that is something that I'm really concerned about, raising two daughters here, and that I've just kept an eagle eye on for all of their childhood.
Mm, thank you so much for sharing that. And I just want to say that I've asked only for the social emotional learning component of this, right? You know, I really hope that our listeners are, you know, not only like just listening, but also empathizing, right? And figuring out, like, doing a bit of introspective work, right? We all want to make sure that we are lifting each other up, and we're also, whatever we're doing is not causing harm to other people, right? So I just appreciate Angela for you digging deeper into that. Does anyone else want to jump in on the question that I had posed, or
I'll speak up.
Awesome.
When you say empathy, that's like one of my favorite words, and that's huge because after Atlanta, it just, all these wounds that we've had that have been festering that we don't look at. I mean, that as Asians, like Angela said, we are like taught, put your head down and just do everything and do it the best, do it better, because we always have to prove ourselves. And so we just live our lives and that's just how it is. But we've been really introspective and we've suffered microaggressions and harms, and we just kind of keep on going. But after Atlanta, we're like, maybe we need to speak up. And so we've started to speak up and we started to have conversations. And I had a conversation with a friend who, she was speaking to a group and she was like almost crying, which we tend to try not to cry in front of other people, many of us, because we don't want to show the hurt. But she started crying, and then she says, no one reached out to me afterwards. And I said, you know what, they're probably not used to you crying to show that emotion, and they might be scared. And so the message to people is, empathy is awesome. Don't ever be scared about being an empathetic person. So maybe you don't realize that your Asian friends have been suffering these wounds, but you can always come and just say, how are you? After Atlanta, so many friends across the country reached out and asked me how I was doing. And that was awesome. And it was appreciated. And that started so many conversations. And I think that road led us to you. So thank you for your allyship. If you weren't such a friendly, wonderful person, I don't think I would have said, like, hey, want some Asian women to come talk on your podcast?
Oh. Well, I'm so glad that y'all are here. Let me just say that again, like for the zillionth time and mean it. But you're absolutely right. Like, people should be reaching out, right? You shouldn't feel like it's awkward. You shouldn't feel like, and can I just also throw up on here, like, when you do reach out, don't make it about you, right? Make it about the person that you're reaching out to. I do want to add that component, right? Yes. So in your reaching out, make sure you're not saying, I'm trying to understand more. Can you tell? No, say, are you okay?
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
And hi, this is Virginia again. I wanted to also highlight that part of coping with what has been happening and being victims of racism and discrimination is finding moments of empowerment. So the four of us have turned to activism as our way to cope by writing letters to our districts, by sharing our lived experiences and the history of the Asian American Pacific Islander community, by reaching out to people who have demonstrated allyship through social media or in our daily lives. That's how we have coped. But you said it so well earlier, Amber, how it does come at a cost, right? It comes at the cost of reopening our wounds. It comes at the cost of being vulnerable. It comes at the cost of jeopardizing or at least adding tension to personal and professional relationships as we start to call out these moments where we are being microaggressed or sometimes overtly experiencing racism.
I think that right there, Virginia, is something that many people take for granted, right? That when you do speak out, it often does come at a cost. So I really, really appreciate you bringing that to the fore. Okay, so I have an anxious questioner here.
In 2016, the United States Department of Education released the State of Racial Diversity in the Education Workforce. The report revealed that 82% of public school teachers are white. Just 2% of these teachers identify as Asian. What inspired each of you to go into education and become teachers?
I can start with that. I know for myself, I come from three generations of educators. My grandfather and grandmother, my grandfather was a principal of a little school where my mom was born. And then my grandma was a teacher at the school. And then my mom was a teacher and all my aunts were teachers. And then I'm the third generation. So it was kind of part of my blood. And I felt as soon as I can remember, I wanted to be a teacher. But I didn't have an Asian American teacher until I was in college. And so most of my influence in going to education was my family, my own family's history. But I think Stacy has a different experience.
For myself, I didn't know I was going to be a teacher. I still didn't know in college. I kind of went back and forth a lot. But when now as an educator, when I think back to my education experience, I think back to my seventh grade teacher, Miss Chan. She was my first Asian teacher and she was Asian American. And I just remember as a young child, just mind blown that here in front of me is an Asian American speaking perfect English, telling stories of her childhood, celebrating Lunar New Year. I remember in English class, we're learning about words that sound the same. And she gave us examples of Chinese words. And that just changed my life. I was like, what is this? And I think back to that because growing up, you know, for me, the only Asian American representation that I really had was like Michelle Kwan. You know, it was just so few. And most adults I saw were, my parents were immigrants. And so most of the adults surrounding me were immigrant parents. But to see this Asian American teacher, you know, commanding this class and not commanding, but just so proud, so strong, and just using her experience, being proud of an Asian American, it really left an impact on me. And I didn't think it left such an impact until now as an educator, when I think back to, you know, important moments of my life growing up. And I look to my students and so many of them have connected with me being Asian American. And that really just reinforces to me how important representation is. That some of the relationships I have with my students, at my one of my first jobs, I was the only Asian American teacher. And, you know, a lot of times the students, you know, came to me asking questions about growing up because I was the first Asian American teacher they were experiencing. And they were asking me what it was like growing up Asian American in Southern California. And then to fast forward to college, when I still didn't know what I was doing yet, but I took this Asian American studies class with Dr. Jennifer Lee. That also was such a pivotal point for me, again, seeing strong, powerful women teaching this class and for the first time reading stories of my life growing up, not just, you know, the little blip of, you know, Asian history. And when we were learning about US history, like I had a whole book about my experience growing up as a child of immigrants in Southern California. And that I think started was a catalyst for me of like, I want to learn more. And why didn't I learn this when I was a child? Why didn't I learn about the Chinese Exclusion Act and how that impacted my family growing up here? And so I think that was something that kind of guided me to want to be a history teacher so that I can incorporate these stories in what I do.
So for Angela, you know, three generations of educators, like, and then, you know, not having an Asian American teacher in your class ever, like, or in your K-12 experience, you know, that has to be just a weird experience. Thank you. Experience, right? Where you're like, yeah, like we be teaching. And then you're just like, where are we? Right. Can you like lean into that a little bit more?
Oh, of course. I had some very influential teachers, and I think I knew what I wanted to do, and pretty early on I knew it was going to be history. So I sort of kept my eye on that. So when I went to college and there was this Asian American, actually she wasn't American, she was Canadian Asian professor who was teaching American history. Like that was just so weird to me. Like But then I ended up taking a class with her for four courses. And she also happened to be the advisor to anyone who was looking to be an education major. So when I sat down with her, she said, hey, you know, looking at your coursework, it looks like you'd be really, really well suited to teach world history. And that, you know, that really laid my path. And to this day, I still remember the kind of impact that made. But you're right. I had very influential teachers, and they did a lot for me. But I think without that representation, it was really hard to see myself, maybe even going into American history. So world history is like, okay, I can do that because that seems a little bit more open, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah. And so then, you know, Stacy sharing, you know, a completely different experience with, you know, you had an Asian American teacher who then also like used culturally relevant pedagogical practices, right, to like engage the class around, you know, English subject matter and like just all kinds of other things. And so, you know, that to me is also just quite interesting. Yeah, and cool. Sophia saying and quite cool. Is there anything else you want to add there, just like driving this point home about representation and, you know, the power of culturally relevant pedagogical practices?
I mean, not much more than that, but just, you know, growing up at the time, I thought nothing of it other than this is kind of cool. But when I reflect truly how impactful that was, like, this is something like really stuck in my brain. I grew up in a predominantly Asian American community. And mostly speaking Cantonese. And so this teacher also spoke Cantonese. And so when she spoke Chinese in class and gave an example of how you can say the same word in different ways to make that connection with English, like it just struck differently. And because of her, I also was more interested in wanting to read more diverse stories. And she helped me find more diverse stories. And that's how I learned about some of the histories that wasn't taught to me in history class. So yes, this was a direct connection to myself being Chinese American that spoke Cantonese. But I think, you know, as an educator now, I try to make sure that I find stories, I find anecdotes, I find experiences that connect to all of my students, because maybe it might just be one thing, but that one thing can leave such an important lasting impact to students when they see themselves represented in the classroom.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you both so much. So this kind of also segues into our next question. Right.
How does your identity inform your teaching?
Sophia, that's such a great question because it's something that I haven't really even thought about. And I'm a world history teacher. And when I first came into teaching world history, I was teaching a lot of history that I'd never studied myself. And I realized how lacking I was in understanding and the knowledge of it. And actually, my very first year stepping into world history, it was a course that was pretty much all European. And they said, oh, we spend a week on China. And I was like, no, there's something wrong with that, because you can't call it world history if it's mostly on Europe. And there is like a week on China, a few days on Africa. And so I spent a lot of time being very intentional about including different cultures, different and different voices that have traditionally not been represented. I couldn't even go to the textbook. The textbook did a terrible job including these voices. So so for instance, like more specifically for, you know, I was teaching modern world history too, and what is being represented on, you know, like Age of Revolutions, for instance, like the American Revolution, the French Revolution. And I was like, those are all like that's the United States and that's Europe. But what about other places? So I really started looking at, you know, the Haitian Revolution. What was going on in Latin America? What is going on in Asia? What is really looking at from a global perspective. And then in my lesson plans, really highlighting.
Hey, Tom, I'm heading to Walmart because you know what season it is.
Oh, is it pumpkin spice season?
No, it's flu season, and Walmart gives flu shots.
Yes, flu season is here, and we've got your back with flu shots where you already shop. Our expert pharmacy team administers each flu shot and can answer your vaccine questions. Stay safe this flu season. Stop by your local Walmart pharmacy and get your flu shot today.
With MailChimp, you get more than a URL. You get an all-in-one marketing platform to help drive sales with things like data-driven recommendations and powerful automation tools. Get started today at MailChimp.com/smartmarketing. MailChimp, built for growing businesses.
Not only people of color, but also female revolutionaries, because we always think about, you know, George Washington on his horse with his sword. You know, that's the image, right, of a revolutionary. And I said, no, there's a lot more out there. And so my lessons include a Latinx woman, a Black woman, an Indigenous woman, and then later turn of the 20th century, like the Mexican female soldiers that fought in the Mexican Revolution, and Chinese revolutionary women that led the charge both on intellectually and also physically. So all of those types of voices are what really get me excited about teaching.
I just want to hop in real quick and just say, yes, the kids and I were looking at each other like, where can we take this class? And also Naima wanted to say something. What did you want to say?
I was hearing like what you were saying, and it really resonated with me, because in my history class, we really only learn about, like, the only diverse places we learn about are Egypt and Mesopotamia, and it's only like the things that are really well known about those places, and we only spend like a few weeks on them, and we don't really get to learn about a lot of different diverse places.
Blind spots in the curriculum create blind spots in our lives, so we need to do better.
Yes, we all need to be in Angela's class. I think these are things that we don't think about, we do, but we've been thinking and discussing all of this a lot. And I never use the word marginalized to describe my experience living as an Asian American woman and teaching in Southern California, but someone used that word, I'm like, you're right, I'm marginalized. And I didn't realize that I've been limited because of a lack of representation. I didn't see myself in history. I didn't see myself in the media. I was talking to my students about my growing up and identity and everything. And I showed them a picture of Farrah Fawcett, who they didn't know because, you know, she's long. She died the same day as Michael Jackson. But and then I talked about how I was like, I don't think I wanted to look like this blonde haired woman, but I spent so many years of my life trying to curl my Asian hair, getting body waves and perms to have this look until I went back to my birth hair, which is much more comfortable. So I think I didn't realize, but I probably wasn't comfortable in my own identity because I didn't see myself around me. And that marginalization gave me imposter syndrome. I didn't know that I was so insecure and always trying to prove myself. I never had that role model that I craved, a really smart, really intelligent Asian American woman educator. I had Asian educators in my life, but I never had that one. And the really neat thing that happened was I went to a seminar at Occidental College, my alma mater, and I met Dr. Jane Hong, and she talked about education through a California lens. And it really resonated with me. And I could learn better than I ever could when I was younger. And I could understand, as she's talking about, you know, all these different events happening through this California lens immigration. And so I started talking to her. And when we went into the pandemic, we started communicating. And then when George Floyd was killed, we started discussing because I didn't understand all these things. And she started explaining things to me. And not all Asians are the same. Everyone was getting mad at the Asian officers and Asians because we have this model minority, and we believed in the model minority myth often. Like, hey, he's making us look bad because we have to have a good face to everyone who's not Asian. It's like, oh, you know, these are Hmong people. They've been harmed. They've been marginalized. Asians is a political term that we've all been stuck together in the same category. And all those things helped me to understand who I am. And when I recognized this, then I recognized my imposter syndrome. I started to get bolder and I started to get more courageous, and you know, reaching out to you, Amber, was one of my, I would have never done that probably a couple of years ago. And it's been exciting to realize that sad to realize how I've been limited, but exciting to see all the possibilities, to see I don't have to accept this. I don't have to accept this, that I can go beyond this, that I can be bold. And so that's why I want to teach my students. That's why I want to show them a diverse, inclusive history. I want them to be critical thinkers, to see history through an empathetic lens, so they're not limited like I was, so that they can see the possibilities, so that they can be active, informed, empathetic citizens who make a difference in this world, so that we, the people, include all the people, not just some of the people.
I think that is absolutely beautiful. Yes, Sophie says, and interesting too. It's Carolee, it sounds like you have been on this journey, and it's almost like a flower, right? Where a flower blooms, right? And you're like petal by petal opening up to the awareness of your own identity, the beauty and the complexity of it. So, you know, I just want to give you a shout out for just taking that journey. I think each and every one of us has to go on that journey. And I think that's part of what we as a society are learning, is that, you know, we use these labels to define ourselves. And many of these labels, they don't quite fit. So how are we going to define ourselves for ourselves, right? So I just really appreciate you sharing that with us. Stacey,
thank you.
I saw your hand up, so I want to make sure that I acknowledge you.
It was just a quick response to Naima's comment about what she's learning in history class, because I teach Mesopotamian Egypt. And I don't know where you are in the world, but Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, which has an awesome virtual exhibit, has a great Ancient Nubia Now. Because if you're going to learn about ancient Egypt, you should also learn about all the amazing achievements of the ancient Nubians. And that was something that I had to learn myself to teach it, because that was not anything I personally learned ever. And even as a history teacher now to middle schoolers, our textbook has like a tiny little section about ancient Kush and the kingdom of Aksum, and like having to find these resources. So Naima, I hope and I want to encourage you to seek out awesome resources to learn this on your own, because like you said, there are amazing, amazing stories around the world. And even though it doesn't come from your history textbook, there are great resources out there. And, you know, foster that curiosity and want to learn more, because once I learned it, the ancient Kush and in Sudan, like their pyramids, which are more than the Egyptians built, it's like something that we should celebrate and learn about.
Shout out to that. Thank you so much for bringing that in here. We will definitely be checking that out. Yeah. Okay, so did we get to everybody about the how does your identity inform your teaching?
I guess I will share a bit too. This is Virginia again, and I had shared earlier that I'm Vietnamese American. One of the moments in my history, in my experience as a student, was that I actually really didn't like history, but I'm a history teacher now, and I love it and live it. But one of the reasons was because I really struggled with trying to find connection, you know, and I got really excited when we got to the Vietnam War part, but I think about it, and it was also painful because the story of the Vietnam War was a story of how America hated the war, how it was considered embarrassing for Americans, and how much, you know, protests were happening around the country. And then at home, my parents were talking about how lucky we are to be in America, how America saved them from communism, how individual American families sponsored us and our my cousins and my aunts and uncles so that we could be here. So like it was, you know, there's that conflict happening with me in my trying to understand my own identity and where I fit in the American landscape. I think about that, and I don't want my students to have to experience that kind of tension. I want them to see themselves in the richness of this country and all the accomplishments that people who look like them have given. I also want them to see the pain and hurt that comes with not acknowledging one's history, you know, not giving a full story, not thinking about the humanity of it all and building on empathy. You know, the empathy is so much of what history is using human stories to build and foster empathy. So I use that experience along with the fact that I'm a mother and I have two young children who are going through school. That informs my teaching because I'm constantly thinking of what is the world that I want for my own children and for the students that I care for.
Yes, Virginia. See, you got an applause from Garvey. yes, Virginia. Can I just say that, you know, I really don't know if educators are thinking of when they're teaching subjects like history, right? Especially with students with a variety of different backgrounds. How does that history lesson hit differently for different students? What is being learned at home, right? And then how do we like integrate that into the classroom? How do we provide space to let students bring their varied vantage points into the classroom?
I think we need to elevate student voices, and I think we also need to listen to them. So I mean, I always feel like an imperfect teacher, but I do. I said I love history, but I love my students more. And so I started after Atlanta. I switched up how I was doing my lessons. I'm like, you know, we need to study the history of anti-Asian violence in America because they need to understand this. But we're not going to stop there. We're going to empower you, and we're going to talk about what you can do. But you need to understand that this incident isn't just one isolated incident, that this has been happening. People just don't talk about it. You know, Asians have been traumatized during the pandemic. Districts and schools need to recognize that Asians have been traumatized during the pandemic. I talk to my kids. I ask them how they're feeling. The Stop AAPI report said there's about 3,800 reported hate incidences across 50 states. 44% of those are in California, where I teach. And these students, where we're talking about going back, but we're just talking about going back physically, and we're talking about filling your form if you're going to stay remote or if you're going to come in person, and you have to stay 6 feet apart or this or that or whatever. But we don't talk about how do you feel about this? How do you feel about returning? It's okay if you don't feel safe returning. They're worrying about their parents going out to the store. They've some of them have personally, you know, experienced hate incidences. My own personal children were standing in line at the store. I wasn't there. They were with dad. And someone called Wuhan on them. And I'm like, what? Like, I thought I lived in a nice, diverse town, and this stuff doesn't happen around here. And that was really disheartening. And so we need to listen, and we need to support. We need to do a better job in our schools than we've been doing. And so many teachers tell students what to do, and they get mad at them for not turning on their screens, but they're not thinking about what's happening at that home. There's multiple people there. You don't want to see dad walking across the screen or whatever. You're traumatized because of all these attacks against Asians that are being seen in the news, etc. You know, the camera isn't the most important thing.
Carolee, thank you so much for that, because we actually talk about that a lot at home. About, first of all, that this is, these are not isolated incidences. And then secondly, about having empathy for Asian students right now, because do you want to share what you said when?
Oh, yeah, sure. So like I said, when the thing popped off in Georgia, and also like when the pandemic first started, a lot of people were like blaming it on Asian people because it started in China. And like I was kind of like worried for all my my friends who are Asian to go back to school, because I didn't want them to get made fun of or called names or have racial slurs thrown at them.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that that's something that schools, districts, PTAs, I'm going to say PTAs as well, right? How do we support Asian students, especially right now, right, where it's super heightened?
I just wanted to kind of just reinforce what you're saying. Like, you know, you brought up that we are all history teachers here, and what are some things that we can do, and how this informs our teaching. Is we all kind of cited where, you know, certain histories or stories are missing from the curriculum. But something I also wanted to point out is that a lot of times our focus when we try to diversify curriculum is you're focusing on all like the terrible moments in history. Like an example with US history is only teaching about slavery, or only teaching about, you know, when, you know, terrible moments happen for people of color. But we also should be celebrating moments of joy, celebrating achievements, so that when students are seeing these stories of themselves, kind of like what Virginia was saying, you're not only just seeing moments in history when you're a victim, but you're able to celebrate achievements that people who look like you made, that we can identify people in history to celebrate because they were the first to do something. So I just want to bring that up, that, you know, when we think about diversifying curriculum, is to try to highlight the joys as well as teaching the hard history.
Stacey, I love what you said, because I think that goes to what, you know, we're teachers because we believe we're here to empower and inspire. And so seeing joy in our curriculum does that, right? I also would like to go back to, like, you know, this whole idea of how do we make sure our students get to tell their own stories in the history. And, you know, it's complicated because you don't know who's walking into your classroom and what their family's history is. So I know Stacey does this as well, because her and I work very closely together, but I have a project at the beginning of my history class. I teach ninth graders, so it's like the beginning of their history experience in high school, that is called the Story Project. And instead of diving into the history that we are covering through standards, we dive into the history of them. And what I mean by that is we ask them to, and I say we as in like my team that I work with at my school, but what we do is we ask them this question of, you know, what's an event in history that has impacted your life? Go interview someone in your life and ask them that question. Many times they're interviewing parents or guardians, adults in their life. And that's where we learn where they're coming from. So instead of telling them what history is, we invite them to tell us what history is. And that's where we amplify voices and give everyone a chance to see themselves in the curriculum right away.
I think that is beautiful. You all have touched upon, like, again, these are all best practices for teaching, but it also just digs into allowing our young people self-exploration and also learning about each other as well during the process. So we're going to ask about a little bit about, like, how do we support, right? So Garvey, you have your question.
How can educators support their AAPI students?
That's a great question, Garvey. I think I touched on this a little bit, and just really listening. It bothers me when I hear teachers getting up, like, you know, remote learning and teaching isn't a fun thing for anyone, for parents, teachers, students, etc. But and so there's a lot of frustration there for parents and for teachers and for students. And I hear a lot of teachers being frustrated. I've referred it to before, you know, about the camera, about this or that, but what about thinking about what can we do to support our students academically, but also emotionally? How can we elevate them? How can we build community in our classrooms? We started having advisory this year, and I love advisory because I love hanging out with these kids. And when we have a 4-day week, we don't have advisory, and I miss them. I've even, a student even like emailed me pictures of her guinea pig so I could stay in touch with her. But also just listening to them, but also showing them, like they said, you know, joy. And not just in the history classrooms. They always put everything on the history classroom, but everyone needs to show their students and listen to their students and show them positive examples of them and everything in their curriculum. And one fun thing, since I've, you know, as I've grown out of my imposter syndrome and I've been more courageous, I've actually reached out to a lot of people, very awesome people, who've come into my classroom so that my students can see what the outside world looks like. So a really great thing that I was happy that I did before I started talking about anti-Asian violence in America, I invited Simon Tam to come into my classroom. He's the founder of The Slants, which was a Asian rock band that brought their case to, they wanted to call themselves The Slants, but the government said, no, you can't do that because that's a racial slur against you, even though they didn't have any really solid evidence, and all these other non-Asian groups were able to call themselves The Slants. So he came and talked to my kids. His case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. He won a unanimous decision to allow them to have that name for their group. And so I brought him into my classroom and he spoke to them. And that was really cool for them to have such a cool Asian talk to them.
I just want to hop in and say that must have been just an amazing experience for your students. Thank you for sharing that. That is kind of dope.
Carolee continues to inspire. Seriously. She's amazing. You know, as much as the four of us are doing, and then you too, Amber, by amplifying our voices and talking to your kids about what the Asian American community is experiencing, that's wonderful, but it cannot fall on just a few shoulders. It has to be something that we continue to build community around. We've narrowed it down to three neat bullet points, right? We're teachers here. We understand the number three is magical. But the three bullet points start with, the first one is like what we're doing right now, right? Learn and teach about our AAPI community. That includes that teachers are learning as well. So one of the easiest ways to do it is to look for AAPI voices out there. So for instance, the four of us, we've been doing our best to amplify the Asian American experience, and through Twitter have been sharing resources and collecting and curating. A couple other suggestions we have just to get you started on learning and teaching is there's this really great documentary on PBS. It's streaming for free now because of what happened in Atlanta. It's called Asian Americans. Host a community viewing event, discuss it, you know, invite the community to come and acknowledge the Asian American experience and learn about it. Other things you can do, which we've been highlighting, is just teach lived experiences of the history of Asian Americans. So that's bullet point number one, learn, teach about the AAPI community. Bullet point number two, empower your AAPI community. It's a community that has continued to be silent many times because it brings less attention to us. We've also been conditioned to feel and be invisible, you know, but now let's change that. Let's empower the AAPI community. One of the ways that the four of us have been empowered is we've each written letters to our districts. Anyone else out there who would like to speak on that and ask your district to stand up for your students, we have a template for you that you can take a look at and pull from so that you can send a letter to your district or school or grade level team or subject or your parents or your child's teacher. You decide. Form communities and clubs specifically for the Asian community so they can speak to each other openly about their experience and not feel so isolated and alone. Examine school curriculum.
build leadership programs that are specifically for, you know, an Asian American population, for other BIPOC populations out there. Build allyship in your district. Believe that people, when they know better, they'll do better. And then include the Asian American experience in your anti-racism, your diversity, equity, inclusion training, because sometimes that's left out. And then the last bullet point is commit. Commit yourself to this. Continue to learn and reflect. And again, we've shared that our resources on our Twitter is like a great place to start. The link tree that we've put together for resources is another place to start. But we're excited to be resources as well.
What can BIPOC parents and white parents do to support AAPI young people and community members?
I would say utilize a lot of the resources that Virginia just spoke about. I don't think that that's, you know, left for just educators in schools only. I think about, you know, our whole communities. And I think one of the easiest thing is representation, finding books that of experiences that are not of your own, because it's about learning about other people's experiences. And there's lots of great book lists out there at all age levels of, you know, of Asian American experience. And so that's one way to do that, you know, watching shows, watching movies that, again, feature characters that have different experience. And so that's an easy way, in addition to then also learning the history and using some of these resources to also understand the perspective and background of Asian Americans.
So I can't wait to add this Linktree link in the show notes. So I'm just going to let everyone know that that link will be available in the show notes, as well as their Twitter handles, so that y'all can follow them. So make sure that that happens. So I just really appreciate that. I didn't want to cut anyone else off. So I want to make sure that if there's anything anyone else wants to say.
There was an article recently written by Sharon Kwan, I think in the Huffington Post, and it was titled, "This is What No One Tells You About Being Asian in America in 2021. And there's a quote there that really resonated with me as an Asian American that, you know, I want people to think about. And it says, "As we continue to practice anti-racism and work towards more diversity and inclusion, individually and collectively, I hope that we can do just that and involve all groups in the discussion. We can't call ourselves anti-racist until we acknowledge all marginalized people, including Asian Americans." And like Virginia touched on earlier, sometimes I feel like Asian Americans or Asians or AAPI get left out in conversations when people are thinking about diversity, equity, inclusion, or anti-racism. And so this is more like a call to action of, we are all committed to anti-racism for all marginalized people, because racism hurts everyone. And so we hope that through this amazing opportunity, Amber, and just being able to share our stories and experiences, and through some of the resources we share, that we can all work together to be anti-racist so that we can all heal as one country.
Stacey, that was amazing. That was a perfect place to kind of wrap, for all of us to kind of meditate on and just think about. And I really appreciate you bringing that. I appreciate you, Angela. I appreciate you, Stacey, Virginia, Kara Lee. Can we all just give them a round of applause, y'all, like we always do? Yes.
Oh my God.
All right. Seriously, we are super thankful that the four of you have decided to come and bring your knowledge and your stories and your vulnerability and your wisdom to our listeners, right? Like, so thank you, thank you, thank you from the bottom of our hearts. We encourage our listeners to go to the show notes, follow these awesome educators who are like killing it. Yes. And then visit that link tree, bookmark the link tree, so that you have it at your, and parents too, bookmark it so you have resources, you have a template, you have no excuse to not be an advocate. You have no excuse now. Ladies, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. This was amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. That was such an honor to be on here.
As we leverage the power of storytelling to understand each other more deeply, let us not forget the work required of each of us to dismantle the ignorance, racism, colorism, and xenophobia that exists around us. Some people might ask, well, what if I get it wrong? You won't know if you're getting it right until you get it wrong. This means we have to open ourselves up to the vulnerability of connection, the beauty of listening with the intent to act, and the humility to engage restoration when we participate in the marginalization of others. This moment is asking each of us to figure out what kind of world we want to live in. Has your school board, place of worship, or place of employment issued a statement in support of the Asian and Pacific Islander community? We challenge families and classrooms to start with the links in the show notes recommended by our guests and then follow Angela, Carolee, Stacy, and Virginia on social media. Remember, it's not one oppression or flavor of racism over another. The AAPI struggle fits into the landscape of the bigger picture in the push for a more just world that requires us to work together to end oppression and fight for justice. As one of my basketball coaches used to say, don't talk about it, be about it. So we need more empathy coupled with more action, stronger coalitions, and more curriculum and policy changes.
Each episode, we will share quotes that we find inspirational.
Linda Sarsawa is an Arab American political activist. Her quote, if you're on the side of the oppressor, or you're defending the oppressor, or you're actually trying to humanize the oppressor, then that's a problem.
Gina Carey is an American filmmaker and soul singer. Her quote, a strong woman looks a challenge dead in the eye and gives it a wink.
Maxie Hong Kingston is a Chinese-American author and professor at the University of California. Her quote, to me, success means effectiveness in the world, that I am able to carry my ideas and values onto the world, that I am able to change it in positive ways.
I'm going to repeat the quote that Stacy Young shared with us from Sharon Kwan's Huffington Post article, This is What No One Tells You About Being Asian in America in 2021. Sharon's quote, as we continue to practice anti-racism and work toward more diversity and inclusion individually and collectively, I hope that we can do just that and involve all groups in the discussion. We can't call ourselves anti-racist until we acknowledge all marginalized people, including Asian Americans.
Thank you for listening to the Less K-12 Better podcast.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe.
We want to hear from you. Connect with us on social media at Let's K-12 Better on all social media platforms, or connect with me on Twitter and Instagram at Mom of All Capes. The Let's K-12 Better podcast is available on every podcasting platform. So if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate and review our podcast. Your feedback helps us grow. Thank you so much for listening.
See you next time.
We did it again. Verizon was just named America's most reliable network by Root Metrics for the 16th time in a row, proving once again that nobody builds networks like Verizon builds networks. That's why we're building 5G right. That's why there's only one best network, Verizon. Best and most reliable based on Root Metrics reports from second half 2013 to first half 2021 of three operators on all network types combined, not specific to 5G networks.
own the road with T-Mobile, the leader in 5G. Whether you're cruising through Nashville on I-40, heading down I-90 to Boston, or touring Santa Cruz in the 5, you'll be covered by the largest 5G network. T-Mobile covers the most interstate highway miles in America with 5G.
See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com. Most reliable according to independent third-party Ookla from crowdsourced user experience data from January to July 2021. Fastest according to OpenSignal awards based on average speeds in USA 5G user experience report July 2021.